You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of June 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Edwards, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Dr. James Boyes of King's College London. James, what are we looking at today?
Well, this morning, three men in trouble: Berlusconi, Obama, and Ed Snowden.
Looking forward to hearing about that. And in Argentina, it's Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner versus the judiciary. We'll ask our man in Buenos Aires why the president is feeling glum right now.
And later in the show, author Keith Morgan will join us in the studio to talk about his new book, Reuters Closet.
We'll also head to the Architecture Without Borders Congress in Vienna to see how activist groups are bringing humanitarian architecture to disadvantaged regions all around the globe.
We try to mix the build culture that they have there with some new techniques so that they can build bigger and better houses for themselves.
All of that, plus we'll get the news from Poland. We will have a Brazilian-themed newspaper review and we'll play some music too. That is all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
A great show in store this morning here on Midori House. I'm looking forward to it, Dom, are you?
I'm like 11 out of 10 looking forward to it.
That's just that much. That's excitement for you people. It's going to be a great show. Stay tuned. Before we get started, let's get the latest news from all around the world with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Militants have attacked the presidential palace and government buildings in the Afghan capital Kabul in the most audacious attack by the Taliban since it was ousted from power 12 years ago. Authorities say all the attackers were killed as they fought with local security forces and members of the CIA, which has an office nearby. The attack, which lasted an hour, comes just days after Afghan President Hamid Karzai raised concerns about peace talks with the Taliban. The Brazilian president has proposed a referendum on political reform in a bid to ease tensions in the country. Dilma Rousseff also promised to boost spending on public transport a week after the country's largest protests in 20 years. She also announced a crackdown on corruption. Meanwhile, FIFA has dismissed concerns that the Confederations Cup football tournament currently taking place in Brazil is at risk. General Secretary of Football's governing body, Jerome Valk, said the country has proved it can host next year's World Cup.
I know that the team of Tahiti was surprised by the level of security around their bus, not being used to, when Spain is definitely used to the security around their bus wherever they are moving, in whatever tournaments they are playing. Things which are happening, it was exactly the same in South Africa. So I don't think that has a link and is linked to the situation. It is just a part of the basic requirements FIFA has in terms of security.
The Emir of Qatar has handed power to his son, telling the nation in a television address that it was time for a new generation to take over. Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani is handing over to his son Tamim. It's 18 years since he seized power from his own father. The United States is demanding the fugitive Edward Snowden is handed over to stand trial in an American court. He's wanted after revealing the existence of a secret US government surveillance program. Mr. Snowden flew from Hong Kong to Moscow at the weekend, despite an extradition request. It's thought his final destination is Ecuador. White House spokesman Jay Carney says explanations from authorities in Hong Kong are unconvincing.
We are just not buying that this was a technical decision by a Hong Kong immigration official. This was a deliberate choice by the government to release a fugitive despite a valid arrest warrant, and that decision unquestionably has a negative impact on the U.S.-China relationship.
South Korea says there's been a cyber attack on its government websites on the anniversary of the start of the Korean War. The website of the presidential office was one of several official and media sites hit by a coordinated attack. In March, South Korea blamed a cyber attack on a number of banking websites on North Korea. Hollywood actress Angelina Jolie has urged the UN Security Council to make dealing with war zone rape a top priority. The special envoy for the UN Refugee Agency told the council that it must shoulder its responsibility to act against the use of rape as a weapon of war. The session was chaired by the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague.
Time has come for the world to take a strong and determined stand to make clear that the systematic use of rape as a weapon of war is not acceptable in the modern world. And our objective is to change the entire global attitude to these issues. It's a big objective.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much. 5 minutes past eight here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Time now to set the agenda. This is the part of the show where our experts choose three big stories we all need to know about in the next 24 hours.
And today's expert is Dr. James Boyce, a friend of the show and visiting research fellow at King's College London. James, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well, chaps. Good to see you both.
Good to see you too. One person that isn't being seen very much, though, Edward Snowden. Where is he then?
Well, this is the big question. And indeed, the three stories we look at this morning all involve individuals who are perhaps under one cloud or another. Let's start with Mr. Snowden. Who is he? Where's he gone? And who's responsible for him? There's an awful lot of ways of studying this story, and he's going to be across the news all for the rest of the week, certainly, if not a lot longer. But one of the great issues here is that in addition to whistleblowing, what he's clearly done is blown out of the water any pretense about the closeness, the relationship between China, Russia and the United States. This idea that there was a sort of a public diplomacy issue going on, that these three superpowers were effectively getting along a lot better now, blown completely out of the water. The Chinese newspaper this morning says that the issue has torn the face off Washington's sanctimonious mask. When you get China and Russia accusing the United States of basically being, harsh and dictatorial, etc., you're in an all sort of a new environment, effectively, and it's going to be fascinating to see where this goes in terms of diplomacy and international relations, I think.
James, I just wonder, sure. do you think it's interesting, or I mean, are you concerned perhaps that the obsession, and it's understandable when you've got this kind of fugitive figure, there's a certain weird sort of romance about it, pictures of his empty plane seat, where's he hiding out? Is this distracting from perhaps the more important underlying issue, which, as you said, there's that diplomatic element, but also in terms of what he was actually exposing, if we go back to that issue itself, and we've seen further information this week about how intolerant the Obama administration is apparently being about whistleblowing generally, about people who are leaking information. Is Snowden in some respects actually distracting people from the more important issue, which is, what were these people getting up to in the first place?
I don't know. I mean, it's fascinating. However, I think whichever focus you're most interested in depends upon, where you want to look with regard to this, because there is that element to the story. There was also another developing story which suggests that this wasn't a guy who just happened to work at the NSA and thought, oh my goodness, this is a spy agency. They spy on countries. How terrible, I should leak this material. The suggestion now is that he deliberately targeted that position to get in there, to get access to the material, and then get it out there. There's stories breaking across the US that this guy was actually in the employ of the Chinese Secret Service. Now, who knows, quite frankly? There's going to be an awful lot of disinformation going out there, and I don't want to perpetuate that, but I guess maybe I already have.
too late.
Too late. Back in there. But this idea that, you're in a very murky world now. You move from being, this guy's just an innocent individual who happened to be outraged, to a whole new era and environment of international espionage, diplomatic relations, and quite frankly, you're almost through the looking glass, and nobody quite knows whether it's black or white at this point.
And the concern that lots of people are having is that he, in his month in China, he has, up until this point, or at least this is the narrative that Snowden has put out there, has been in charge of what's leaked, how it's leaked, who has the information, that who gets past the information that he has. And presumably there is a pretty strong possibility that en masse information is now in the hands of the Chinese.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he was in Hong Kong. People think of Hong Kong, I think, still to a certain degree of, oh, well, that's just like an ex-British colony there. Everything's okay. But of course, that's no longer the case. Who knows what he was doing there? He's also now supposedly in Moscow, although nobody seems to have seen him at the airport. Nobody really has an idea about where he is or what he's doing. Don't forget, this is fascinating. You know, his passport was revoked when he was in Hong Kong. If it was any of us, we wouldn't have been allowed near an airplane, let alone through customs. He didn't have a visa to fly to Russia, by all accounts. So, you know, we've got a serious situation here whereby the diplomatic part, well, the diplomatic relations element of this is fascinating. You've got Russia effectively allowing an individual onto an aircraft to enter its country, supposedly, without a passport, without a visa. We couldn't do that. So why is this being allowed to happen? You've got the United States' requests for an arrest warrant being denied by the Chinese authorities in Hong Kong, as Top News Hour reported. If it was any of us, we'd know about being held by the Chinese authority on the basis of, well, we don't want to alienate the United States. So there's clearly a lot more going on here. And I think that, to return to your earlier question, I think is almost the bigger question. There's no doubt the Obama administration has been used the Espionage Act to a disproportionate degree. It's prosecuted more people in 6 years than has ever been done by all presidents combined since 1917 when the law was passed. So there's some serious questions to be asked about that. But a bigger picture as well is emerging here, I think.
Fascinating stuff. That's, you mentioned Barack Obama there.
Yep.
Let's talk about him in well, a slightly different context.
Sure.
It's always interesting, I find, how second-term US presidents often try and, you know, paint themselves as the international statesman. What's Obama up to at the moment? Where is he?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's traditional that American presidents focus on the domestic in their first term and international in their second term to try and get a legacy for themselves as a statesman. Barack Obama is going to be engaging in quite a contentious trip to the African continent this week. There's a lot of people back home saying this is costing a fortune, the numbers involved are huge. Why are we doing this at a time of relative austerity? He will say, well, I'm taking a lot of people there to generate business. One of the great questions, of course, is will he meet Mandela, the first African black head of state from South Africa, of course, meeting potentially the first United States black president. Nobody knows whether that's going to happen or not. There's suggestions, well, would it be exploiting Mandela, of course, in an hour where he's ailing? We'll have to wait and see. But certainly he's not going to get the sort of red carpet treatment by a number of the organizations that you would expect him to have generated. And I think this has a lot to do with, you know, issues like the Snowden issue, issues to do with, you know, some of the things that his administration are beginning up to, the use of drones, which are now being stationed on the African continent, of course. So this idea that the luster has really come off the Obama presidency very, very quickly. He's only 6 months into his second term in office, and already people like Politico are saying, you know, where is this presidency going? How is it going to run out for the next 3.5 years? He's very much lost a lot of his credibility at home, and now we're seeing overseas as well.
His predecessor managed to keep a lot of luster on his presidency, or at least grab a few specks of luster. I don't know what the unit of luster is. Maybe it's a speck. So George W. Bush had a relatively good reputation internationally in relation to the way he dealt with Africa in his second term. And that was perhaps the only area in which he had a decent international reputation. So I wonder if we're being comparative here, have we got any indicators of how he's going to compare in his African journey to his predecessor?
Well, everything's relative, of course. And I think the issue beforehand, you had so many people had such low expectations of George W. Bush that he could only really exceed them. Whereas with Barack Obama, of course, everybody thought he was the second coming to a certain degree when he got elected compared to George W. Bush. The irony, of course, with George W. Bush is that even Bob Geldof has said, listen, I love Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was a great guy, but he did, fill in the blank, nothing effectively for Africa.
Is that a swear word?
It was typically there.
Okay. Just checking.
I'm just trying to, you know, stay within the realms of reasonableness.
I appreciate
here.
It. Thanks.
Like to come back again. And please. Whereas George W. Bush gave a fortune in terms of AIDS relief to Africa. So we're talking here about expectations and everything's relative, of course. But yes, George W. Bush had a very, very different situation with regard to Africa, and we will recognize that, I think.
Just finally on this point, sure. It's interesting. There was an interesting poll this week about George W. Bush's popularity at home, mm-hmm. and it's now overtaken his unpopularity decisively for the first time, I think, since he left office. It's interesting, isn't it, looking at Obama, he's trying to play the diplomat. It's not going well for him. History seems to judge US presidents very kindly, though, certainly at home. Sure. Do you think that the same will apply to Obama? Is it a kind of thing, it's a default setting that once they're gone, people look back and think, actually, this was a great guy? Or do you think that sense of kind of almost disappointment that you alluded to there risks tarnishing his reputation into the longer term?
There's no doubt about it. There's a certain sentimentality to Americans and their beholding of the presidency. When Harry Truman left office in January 1953, he did so with opinion poll ratings very similar to George W. Bush in the low 20s. People saying his foreign policy was a joke and a disaster and he brought effective shame upon the United States. Now we look back on a Truman presidency and say, well, hang about, he issued in an era of containment that was seen to be successful in the Cold War. His opinion poll ratings are generally very, very high. And now both Democrat and Republican presidents try to claim the Truman mantle effectively year in, year out. You've seen an upsurge in the opinion poll ratings for George W. Bush, possibly in the last couple of weeks because of the opening of his presidential library. There's a lot of light on him for that reason. And also because of a sense of disappointment, I think, with Barack Obama across the board in many, many areas within the United States that may be saying, well, actually, you know what? Maybe W. wasn't quite so bad after all.
James, speaking of the inexplicably popular, Berlusconi found guilty, was it yesterday or the day before?
Yeah, it was yesterday.
Not entirely surprising for watchers of this case. Also, not something that's likely to end in any sort of jail term anytime soon because of the Italian legal system. What are the implications?
Yeah, the implications are ridiculous. This is a former leader of the Italian state who's been caught and acknowledged to have these bunga bunga parties. I mean, if you can be head of state anywhere, I mean, Italy doesn't sound so bad, does it, necessarily?
It's great fun.
There's a lovely line I heard. Bill Clinton apparently visited Berlusconi when he was leading Italy and went into his office. And there was what you'd expect in an Italian leader's office. It was a painting from a museum of a semi-naked girl. And Clinton looked at it and said, "You imagine if I put that up in the Oval Office?"
Well, he probably tried.
He probably tried. Couldn't get away with it. And it speaks volumes, I think, to the difference between Italian culture and American culture. You can take a piece of art from an Italian museum, put it up in the Italian leadership's office, no problem whatsoever. You try that in the United States, they'll probably impeach you.
But just briefly on this, obviously, sure. He was handed down a sort of jail sentence, banned from political office. Yeah. Obviously, he is advancing in years. We don't believe he's going to go to jail. But politically, does this help to spell the end? Or is it likely that he'll still drag himself back from this latest setback and be back in frontline politics again? What's your gut instinct?
Berlusconi is one of these people. He just won't go away. He returns to power on a pretty regular basis. But I think if you consider his age, the fact that he's supposedly been banned from holding office now for life, he's got a 7-year sentence hanging over him. He's going to appeal it, of course, but it's difficult to see even the Italians, I think, returning to power someone who's been found guilty of effectively sex with an underage individual. It's very difficult to see how even he could walk this back from this point, I think.
Dr. James Boyes, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Dr. James Boyes is Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London.
The results are out. Monocle's 7th annual Quality of Life survey has shuffled the deck and ranks the cities we think are most livable in 2013. And the winner is Copenhagen.
This is a population and a city that's become markedly more extrovert in recent years. There's more life on the streets than ever before, and its people are not only more engaged locally, but also eager to show Copenhagen off to the rest of the world. Copenhageners have hit a high point of pride in their city, and it shows.
Copenhagen, our film about the best city to call home. On Monocle.com.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the U.S. and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing, every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, if you're an under-pressure leader of a cash-strapped nation, it might seem a curious strategy to pick a fight over judicial independence. But that has been the unusual tactic deployed by Argentina's Cristina Fernández de Kirchner. Back in April, the president managed to force through Congress a number of bills limiting court's powers to use injunctions against the state and insisting that a majority of the magistrates that appoint judges adopt a party political affiliation.
But now, a comprehensive defeat for de Kirchner's measures in the Supreme Court has dealt an apparently devastating blow to this bid. But some observers have been suggesting that this may all be part of some sort of grand plan by Cristina to address judicial reform, with half an eye on constitutional changes that could allow her to run for a third term. So what exactly is she up to, and where does this verdict leave the country? Well, joining us now from Buenos Aires is Monocle's correspondent, Ed Stocker. Ed, welcome back to the programme. We alluded there to the slightly baffling nature of these at first glance. What exactly is she up to?
Indeed. I mean, she likes to pick a fight, the president of Argentina, and this time she has in her sights the judiciary. I mean, on the surface and how she's been presenting it, is the need to kind of democratize, the need to change the judicial system, the need to modernize it. This kind of really has its roots in the end of last year, a very high-profile case within Argentina in the city of Tucumán in the northwest of the country. Essentially, it was a sex case over a woman called Marita Verdón, who disappeared 10 years ago in what's thought to be a sex trafficking case. Now, there were some 13 people implicated in the court case, but they were all cleared in what was widely seen to be, you know, a miscarriage of justice. And the president herself, you know, was on television and meeting the mother of the victim, claiming that this was a huge miscarriage of justice and the justice system was, corrupt. So that was kind of the basis for this huge change. The cynics and the people who are against the government are suggesting that this is really simply a way for the government to try and control the justice system, a justice system that has got in its way consistently when it's tried to pass laws that are favorable towards its government. I guess the most high profile of these is the media law, which was actually passed as far back as 2009, but has been held up by a series of injunctions and legal hoops by the country's biggest media empire, Clarín. So I think it's kind of the government's fed up of all these sort of these inconveniences the justice system is causing it. And that's certainly, I think, a big factor in why it wants to reform the system.
Ed, it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because a lot of other observers have said, well, hang on, look, Cristina's too savvy. She's too canny a political operator to have risked such a damaging defeat and to have taken on this kind of challenge so head on, knowing surely, as she must have done, that it was likely to falter. They then suggest that, in fact, she almost, well, it was a defeat almost by design, and that at the real heart of this is still a kind of a general opposition to the judiciary, but it's more about looking ahead in terms of her own political interests, looking to this potential third term, which would involve some form of broader constitutional reform. Do you think there's any truth to that, or is that just simply too cynical, even for the even for Argentine politics at the moment?
I think it's possible, indeed. I mean, the Supreme Court ruling of last week basically said that, you know, you can't do this. The only way that, you know, you're able to bring through these reforms is to actually amend the constitution. So, I mean, it's been long, I guess, a fear of the people who are against Cristina Kirchner, the opposition and, you know, the general public who don't like her. There's this kind of fear that's regularly tapped up, and we'll have to wait and see how true or not it is, that she wants to change the constitution in order to run for a third term. So obviously, at the moment, the law says that you can't run for a third term. Just quickly to finish, I mean, in order for her to do that, she needs a two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress. So, which isn't easy, you know, it's not good. That would not be an easy task for her to achieve that, even though, you know, at the moment she's got a majority. Obviously, we've got midterms coming up in October, which is going to change the makeup of those two houses as well. So I think we'll know a lot more over the next few months as to, you know, the possibilities of these things happening.
It's a situation we'll watch very closely. Ed Stocker, thanks for joining us. That's Monocle's Buenos Aires correspondent, Ed Stocker, joining us here on Midori House.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Tom Edwards. Now, difficult climate conditions and endemic poverty, which plague the world's many underdeveloped countries, call for new approaches to housing and shelter in those areas. Structures of marble and stone are not for them. Instead, they need something more affordable and suitable for the harsh conditions. Architecture Without Borders Austria is one of a number of activist groups that are bringing humanitarian architecture to disadvantaged regions around the globe.
It's currently running projects in Alaska, Bhutan, and South Sudan. For this week's edition of Section D, our Austria correspondent, Alexei Korolyov, went to the Architecture Without Borders Congress in Vienna to find out more about the group's work.
Architecture Without Borders Austria is only about a year old, but it's already reaching out to the world's furthest flung communities.
We want to bring architecture to places where there is no money or no thought of architecture.
Gunda Maurer is the founder and director of the group. Speaking ahead of the opening of the Architecture Without Borders second annual congress in Vienna, Maurer says it's all about exchanging knowledge and practices.
We try to mix the build culture that they have there with some new techniques so that they can build bigger and better houses for themselves.
One of the group's projects is the redevelopment of the village of Melut in South Sudan. Yasmin Blaschek is a member of the Architecture Without Borders team, which is working closely with the native craftsmen there.
We are doing earth architecture, clay architecture there. They are experienced with work like that, and the roof is out of straw, so it's there are handicraft people there who know that.
Blaschek says the group helps the Sudanese maintain their traditional building techniques.
We show them, with our interest in their architecture, that they should stay on their traditions, should keep on their traditions, and so that they get more self-confident, actually, again.
Another area to which the group is trying to contribute is the distant coastal community of Kivalina in the US state of Alaska. A local news report highlights Kivalina's remoteness.
Kivalina is remote even by Alaska standards, almost 150 miles north of Kotzebue, 1,000 miles from Anchorage. It's nestled on a thin gravel spit separating the Chukchi Sea from the frozen Kivalina Lagoon.
Architect Philip Benish has been researching the tiny Inupiat community.
It's really isolated. It's just 370 inhabitants, and so people do not have work, they have lots of social problems, and the climate, of course, is harsh.
Benish says Kivalina's inhabitants need a place to congregate indoors and discuss their problems.
They're lacking appropriate possibilities to gather, to meet in like bigger buildings.
Architecture Without Borders plans to upgrade the village's old community centre, Benish says, as he shows a video clip in which the group used Lego bricks and minifigures to present draft plans for the building.
We would love to come to Kivalina and to work with you on your community center. So our target is now in summer to go there, to have our first contacts with the community, to start a bottom-up process, to see what people there feel about the community center, what they want, they need.
Jashar Hanstad of Norway's TYIN Technistuo Architects says visiting the actual site of work is a must if you want to build responsibly.
Like we always say, that we never design anything before we actually come down to the area we're working.
TYIN architects have built low-cost projects in Thailand, Uganda and Indonesia. Their latest project is a training centre for cinnamon farmers on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. Hanstad says it helped create new jobs.
All of our projects are just meant as a small start of something, some positive change in the area. So, for example, in the cinnamon school that we did, we have hundreds of people working there right now.
But Hanstad says it doesn't mean that TYIN are humanitarians.
I don't consider us as humanitarian architects, and I don't know if there is such a thing as humanitarian architects, because I've also been visiting, for example, Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and I see that it's a limitation of where architects are actually needed.
In fact, you can make money from assisting underdeveloped communities, says Fabian Waldmüller of Architecture Without Borders.
My idea is actually that you could also make a business out of that. So I think it's also okay to look at it like that, because in the end it's work we are doing, and work should also be paid. It's also a way to take it more seriously, because at the moment it's more like a hobby, what we are doing.
However, Waldmüller is realistic about the impact of the group's work.
It's certainly not going to be the cure of the world, but at the same time I think it's biggest field you could work in architecture, because actually if you start working non-profit, there is the whole world actually you could work for.
For Yashar Hanstad of TYIN Architects, the most important thing about this type of work is that it is a two-way process.
We are learning from the people we work with how to build these wonderful bamboo facades, for example, or how to make these mud walls. On the other hand, of course, we have knowledge in terms of how the structure should be built, and it's definitely a collaboration between us and the locals that have all these hundreds of years of experience in building in the area.
For Monocle in Vienna, I am Alexei Korolev.
And elsewhere on Section D, we'll chat with the creative director of Uniqlo, the designer of Berlin-based menswear atelier, a dandy of the grotesque, and we drop by the studio of London-based jewellery designer Hannah Martin. All that and more tonight at 1900 hours London time.
Now, in the next half hour of today's Midori House, we'll be hearing the shocking story of one Lithuanian family in the Second World War. The author of new book, Reuters Closet, will be joining us shortly. Plus, we'll see what our correspondent is doing in Miomsen. That's a small village in southeast Poland, of course, but why is he there? We will find out. We'll also review the morning's newspapers with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Before all of that, David Spence is here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. Taliban insurgents have attacked the presidential palace and nearby buildings in central Kabul. Police say two Afghan guards died and all the attackers were killed. The Defence Ministry and an office housing the CIA's Afghan office were also targeted. Qatar's Emir Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani is stepping down and handing power to his son Sheikh Tamim, the 33-year-old Crown Prince. In a speech broadcast on Qatar state television, the 61-year-old said it was time for a new generation to take over. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff has moved to calm recent protests by proposing a referendum on political reform. She's also promised to boost spending on public transport and put more focus on health and education. The US has criticised Russia and China after fugitive Edward Snowden managed to fly from Hong Kong to Moscow. He's wanted after revealing the existence of a secret US government surveillance programme. South Korea says several official websites have been the subject of a cyber attack. No one has claimed responsibility, but messages praising North Korea and claiming hacking collective Anonymous was responsible were left on hacked sites. Anonymous has denied any involvement. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24. London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House. Now, the World War II experience of the Lithuanian Jewish people isn't one which historically has garnered lots of attention, but Lithuania was a nation in which neighbours were complicit in the brutal treatment of neighbours and families had to cling together for safety.
One of those families was Ruta Kron, her parents and her little sister. Their ordeal started in 1941 when their life in the small town of Shavel was turned upside down by the invasion of the Nazis. Their stories told in a new book by Keith Morgan called Ruta's Closet. It's based on extensive interviews with Ruta Kron. I'm delighted to say that Keith Morgan joins us here in the studio now. Keith, welcome to Midori House. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
for joining us. I guess the thing with stories of this type often is to look at their genesis. I wondered, how did you come to sort of tell this particular story? We're perhaps familiar with some of the stories of the excesses, the terrible privations people suffered. What was it about this story and how did you kind of come across it in the first place?
Well, as you can tell from my interesting accent, I'm a cross between Brit and Canadian now. And I'm a newspaper guy with a nose for a story. And I hate to say this, but a British schoolboy's history, you know, I knew about the concentration camps. And I many years ago, I ran into people who put me right on this and said, there's more to this. And I said, one of these days when I'm older, I'll write something of significance. And there I was 20 plus years later in Vancouver, writing a column about people who make a difference to others. And I came across Ruth, as she's known, or was known, of course, in Canada. And she told me the story, and it haunted me for 2 years. It absolutely haunted me. And the part that haunted me was the loss of her four-year-old sister at the time. She was seven, the way she was scooped up and taken to Auschwitz. And I came back to Ruth, and I said, you know, we should do a story on this. This is a different kind of story. And she said, sure, do that. And what was supposed to be a two-year venture became 10 years, but that's how I got into it.
And we've since lost Ruth. She died in 2008,
she
I
did,
believe.
Of cancer, yes.
And
yes.
I wonder, she clearly, you were very affected by her story, and it there are so many moving parts to this story, but what about it did you feel, with your sort of journalist's hat on, was the bit that people needed to know about, the new bit, the new angle to it?
I think the trouble is it's an old angle, but too few people knew about it or know about it, to be honest with you. It's been the Lithuanian and the Baltic situation in general has been something that's been pretty much restricted to academia, the historians. And I was shocked, and I thought people should be aware of just how many Jews were killed there, how complicit people were, their neighbors, their former neighbors. I thought it was a hidden part of the Holocaust that should be brought out. But I was also thinking that there's so many rich stories and rich characters in this book, which is nothing to do with me. They just are. And I wanted people to actually get something positive out of this as well, because, you know, ultimately it is the classic story of the triumph of good over evil in the way this ends up, this book. And I think it's very inspirational. And, you know, the way I've put it a number of times when I'm signing the books, if I have time to write, I usually say, you know, this is a lesson from yesterday to be learned today and remembered tomorrow. It's very relevant.
And I just wonder about that then, in terms of the legacy, going through these stories, looking particularly at that sense of betrayal, the particular unique horror of having a neighbour, an erstwhile friend turned foe in such devastating fashion. What do you think the legacy is that? When you write a book like this, with the advantage, if you like, of the historical perspective, how damaging is that to these societies? Is there any sense of repair, do you think, with all this time? Or is the experiences were simply too bitter and too strong to allow for that to happen?
It's a complex issue, particularly so in the former Soviet countries. There seems to be a reluctance to repair in many ways. There's lots of public noise made about it. You know, we'll have an inquiry into this, and it, you know, it doesn't seem to get very far. And they seem to be trying to continue this scapegoating. You know, that particularly in Lithuania, there's this need, it seems, to portray a double genocide as though what happened with the Soviets after was somehow, you know, a moral equivalency to what happened in the Holocaust. And it's clearly not. And it misrepresents it. Now, that's not to say there aren't a lot of people in Lithuania who are dealing with this. But I get extremely upset with the current government that just doesn't seem to want to really face up to this. And to keep bringing them side by side, I think, does a tremendous disservice to the Jews. You know, we've had recent examples here in Britain. I don't know if you've been writing a few things about this, you know, where, you know, the Minister for Europe here is saying, oh, no, that's the business of Lithuania. Well, no, it's not. You know, they're in the European Union. We've got a rise in fascism there. We've got parades, the swastika's back. We have some terrible stuff appearing in the media. It's not gone away, you know. And if you when you read the book, you'll see that we, Ruth and myself, really got motivated to get serious about doing this when we started to see graves being damaged back in the early 2000s. It's got worse.
And I wonder, you talk there about the issue of sort of responsibility and the contemporary responsibilities of government, and tied up in that idea is the idea of conscience, and conscience is a big theme that runs through the book in various different forms. We don't have your key interviewee with us today, unfortunately, to be able to give her side of things, but talk to us about how important in the telling of this tale and how it relates to the present day conscience is.
I think that let's look at, from the point of view of Lithuania, I'm not a Lithuanian, so it's hard for me to do that, but Ruth talked about she'd like to see some acknowledgement, instead of scapegoating, as I've said. She wanted to warn today's generation there, as well as in the West, as to what went on and how easily it can slip back into that. I think she also talked a great deal about, just as you have, about conscience and the need to use that experience for the future. Not sure that totally answers your question, because I'm not Ruth, but I think there's a lot can be done, and I think Germany has dealt with this so differently. You know, and you can see that. I mean, there are no more avid anti-Nazis than in Germany, you know. And I think we're all looking for something like that, and an acknowledgement. I mean, the horror of this is you go to modern day Lithuania, and there's not many villages in the country that there aren't some mass graves outside.
Okay.
Scary.
Keith, I'm afraid we will have to leave it there. But Keith Morgan's book is called Reuters Closet. When will it be available to people?
It's actually out now.
Okay.
Yes.
Keith Morgan, thanks very much for joining us on the Dory House.
You're welcome.
Monocle 24 continues its global summer tour with a stop-off in Thailand. This week, we'll be touching down in Bangkok for two very special editions of The Briefing. On Wednesday and Thursday this week, The Briefing will be coming live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre, presented by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and editor Andrew Tuck. We'll be bringing you a snappy roundup of the current state of affairs in Thailand's creative scene, and meet the people making waves in Bangkok's thriving design community. So tune into The Briefing at midday UK time and 1800 in Thailand. On Wednesday and Thursday this week, live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre in Bangkok, right here on Monocle 24.
am here in London, 9:43 in Warsaw, and indeed in Mjensen,
where we head now. Joining us on the line from this small village in southeast Poland is our man there, Gulliver Cragg. Gulliver, welcome to the show. So tell us a little bit about Mjensen. What exactly are you up to there?
Your second attempt at pronunciation was a bit better than the first. It's Mjensen. I've just been practicing it. Basically, I've come down here to check out the beginnings of what seems to be a protest movement in Poland against shale gas exploration. If you remember, for the past 3 years or so, Poland has been the scene of sort of great hopes that it could be getting rich due to large amounts of shale gas located under its soil, but people are beginning just to realize that the environmental consequences of this might make it not worth doing. But it's really only in this one area that real protests have started. And right now in Myeongsin, people from surrounding villages have come to support an attempt to get the mayor of this village to show the documents that Chevron have given to him concerning their explorations. Nearby, they appear to be building a road. They appear to be making preparations to drill. And apparently, they really haven't told the local people what they exactly plan to do. And this has been the case in a lot of places in Poland, that large multinationals have moved in, got concessions to prospect for shale gas, and then haven't really informed local people exactly what they're doing, or if they have done, sort of only doing things by halves. And it's beginning to get people's goat. And it's just nearby here that there's a field that farmers have occupied to prevent Chevron moving in there. Chevron had leased this field, and they've called it Occupy Chevron, and they've set up a sort of permanent protest there. But it's just really only the very beginnings of protesting in Poland, because still more than three quarters of the population, surveys show, are still very much in favor of trying to get this shale gas out of the ground, because they think it's going to make Poland rich.
Well, that's, I guess, what I wonder about this, because at the start of a protest movement is one thing, and of course people generally don't enjoy it when multinationals come along and start drilling down, or potentially preparing to drill down in their backyard, so to speak. But is it drawing people from further afield, or is it just those in the local community who aren't wild about these companies turning up?
Well, environmental activists from Warsaw have been reacted with great enthusiasm to the local farmers around here being unhappy about it, and have joined them and are really doing their best to get sort of attention of national media and foreign media. But it has to be said that Polish national media seem really quite reluctant to cover people protesting against shale gas exploration. The angle that most Polish media have taken until recently has been, is this gas there? What impact is it going to have on our economy? But even looking at things from that angle, it's all beginning to look a little bit less rosy. Already two big American companies, Exxon and I think Talisman, is that right, have pulled out of Poland because they said that their initial explorations didn't give such positive results as they thought. American geologists have scaled down their estimates of exactly how much the shale gas reserves are. It looks like technically, even without the protests, it may be that this gas is going to be a lot harder to get out of the ground as was initially hoped.
Now, Gulliver, a little later in the programme, we're going to be talking about Brazil and, well, protests we've seen there, which have been, well, partly protesting about government waste, or that's the public perception at least, on organising big international events like the World Cup. I wonder, it's quite interesting getting your perspective from Poland. We're obviously about a year, well, almost exactly 1 year after Euro 2012, one of Europe's biggest sporting endeavours. Poland obviously spent a great deal of money. What's the feeling there? Is there a sense that it was a waste? Has there been any kind of lasting legacy, a lasting benefit? Is it possible to kind of gauge public reaction?
Well, a year ago, Euro 2012 was in full swing, and there really was an atmosphere of euphoria in Poland at the time, despite the poor performance of the Polish team. And the question now is, you know, what is left from that? Once the euphoria has died down, what has Poland really gained? And the stories in the media are all quite negative about that at the moment. For one thing, there are four stadiums that were built or refurbished for Euro 2012, and that all promised that they would be making money already by now. Well, they're not. In Gdańsk, Poznan, Wrocław and Warsaw, it's the same story. The stadiums are losing money, and in some cases haven't even managed to finish paying off the contractors who helped build them. One Austrian company, Alpine Bau, which helped build stadiums and also roads as part of the preparations for Euro 2012 in Poland, has gone bust. There are also Polish contractors involved who've had to file for bankruptcy. And now it's emerged that the Polish road building, which is a state organization, the Polish Road Building Authority, didn't pay its contractors. And so there's quite a lot of embarrassment about that sort of thing, and the feeling that the state may be having to prop up these white elephants for some time to come. But the people managing the stadiums are still promising that within a year or two they will all be profitable. But it's hard to see exactly how they're going to do that. The National Stadium in Warsaw, for example, has no club that plays there. It's dependent on organizing events, big concerts. Paul McCartney played there on Saturday, but these concerts seem to be a bit too few and far between for the moment.
Yeah, Paul McCartney will not save a stadium by himself, regardless of what he'll tell you. I wonder, Euro 2012 clearly has left something of a sour taste, perhaps increasingly in the mouths of Poles, and clearly the activities that companies are being allowed to get up to as regards shale gas, as you're explaining, potentially controversial as well. How's this all impacting on the popularity of the government?
Yeah, well, I think the feeling that Euro 2012 was not actually such a showcase of the Polish government's good management as the Polish government hoped it would come across as, and that there were lots of errors made. There are other errors I didn't mention, such as infrastructure that was completed in a rush and seems to have been poorly done. A train derailed on the new railway to Warsaw's airport just a couple of days ago. And all that feeling that there was mismanagement involved in that, and that there has been also mismanagement involved in the shale gas, or broken promises rather, that the government was going all guns blazing with great enthusiasm, bring on all these American companies and we'll all get rich. And now it seems like, well, seems like these American companies aren't really treating the local people the way they ought to, and it seems like there was an exaggeration. All of these contribute to an atmosphere of rather disappointed hopes and broken promises surrounding Donald Tusk's government, and that is in a context where the economy, although seen from a European perspective, Poland remains one of the countries that's been doing best through this crisis, is slowing now. The economy is very much slowing. It's only around 1% growth expected this year. Poles are beginning to feel this in their pockets, and that is showing up in the opinion surveys, where for the past few months, Donald Tusk's Civic Platform Party has been a few points behind Jarosław Kaczyński's pretty right-wing nationalist Law and Justice Party. The latest survey I saw this morning put Law and Justice on 31% and Civic Platform on 26%. So the idea, which to many liberal Poles remains a sort of unthinkable horror, of Jarosław Kaczyński returning to power. He had a disastrous stint as Prime Minister in a few years leading up to 2007, when Donald Tusk was elected. And it just sort of seems to be beginning to be a possibility that Jarosław Kaczyński actually might be able to scrape a victory in the 2015 elections. And yes, so things are looking a bit wobbly for Donald Tusk's government at the moment, to say the least.
Gulliver Cragg, our man in Poland, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House, where we'll be having a leaf through the Brazilian papers in just a moment. But I want to, let's get some up-tempo Brazilian beats.
Okay.
How do you feel about that?
I feel excellent about it. I wonder what they're going to be.
I think they might be Gabriel Valim with Piradinha.
Piradinha, ela tá maluca, ela tá doidinha. Piradinha, ela tá doidona, fora da casinha. Ela desfila quando chega na festa, arrasa na pista, a galera olha, todo mundo quer pegar. Mas ela tá de boa, só querendo dançar. Mas depois de tempo bebe e fica piradinha. Ela desce do salto, a gatinha perde a linha. Piradinha, ela tá maluca, ela tá doidinha. Quando chega na festa, arrasa na pista, a galera olha, todo mundo quer pegar, mas ela tá de boa.
That was Piradinha by Gabriel Valim, which is like a kind of crazy little girl, I think is fair to characterize it. And we're joined by Monocle's
Crazy little guy. Yeah. It's Fernando Pacheco. Welcome to Midori House this morning.
It's a great song, you know, to start the morning in a very energetic way. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's on the charts, Brazilian
charts. That's kind of the music I hear when I see you approaching, Fernando.
Oh, fantastic. Well, except that this is the song of a gold digger in the latest soap opera. I'm not a gold digger, Tom.
That wasn't what I meant, of course, Fernando.
Of course.
What's the soap opera and should we be watching it?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I'm addicted. I'm watching every day, you
What's
know?
What's it called?
And it's called Amor à Vida.
Okay.
And this character, her name is Valdirene, is played by actress Tata Werneck.
Uh-huh.
And she's so funny. I mean, she used to be a comedian and then Globo hired her because she became so popular. And then there's a scene where Neymar, our footballer, he's in the room and she managed to invade his room. And she's kind of half naked in bed when he arrives and then he's so scared and he tries to run and of course they start playing the song, you know.
It's music play.
Yeah,
it's fabulous.
It's fabulous.
What
know?
An amazing audio trail for some lunchtime viewing,
exactly.
I imagine that. Beyond soap operas, what's going on back home then?
Well, I have to say we have only one story in front of a Globo and Folha de São Paulo, and actually for me it's quite positive news, you know, because I was feeling quite sad about what was going on in Brazil in the last days. But finally, you know, as you can see here on the cover of O Globo, there's a picture of Dilma and her vice president, Michel Temer, and chief of staff, Gleisi Hoffmann. She invited all the 27 state governors in Brazil and 26 mayors of the big capitals in Brazil to discuss what has been going on in the country. And she announced historic measures, like she's even going to include a political referendum on political reforms, actually, which... they don't have the date yet, but apparently it's going to be on the 7th of September or the 15th of November, which are very important dates in Brazil. 7th of September is the day where we became independent and the 15th of November when we became a republic. So I think it's quite positive. And she finally did something. She finally kind of gave a speech because Dilma used to be... She's quite media shy. She almost doesn't give interviews to the press, you know. So in this sense, she's a bit different from Lula, our previous president, which was more charismatic, more open. She's very kind of reserved. And sometimes that's bad, in my opinion.
I just wonder, though, Fernando, it seems like a decisive act. But do you think, given the instability, the dissatisfaction, will this be enough? Do you think people will be appeased by this? Will it quiet and will it dampen down the spirit of protest? Or do you think people will still say, you know, enough isn't enough? The eyes of the world remain on Brazil because of Confederation's Cup and for other reasons. Do you think that a number of protesters will still try to continue to exploit that focus of the world by continuing to protest?
I think that the protests are still going on, and actually, and there's especially because tomorrow Brazil's playing against Uruguay, the big semi-final of the Confederation's Cup, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of protests in Minas Gerais. But I do think that this going to improve because she gave a speech, I think, like about a week ago, and people were not satisfied by that. But I think now with proper measures, and including she was the first president to say that she's going to make corruption, she's going to be tougher penalties to corruption, and no other Brazilian president ever said that. So I think that's quite important and historical, in my opinion.
I mean, we were watching a sort of lack of action from the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan in the last few weeks. This situation, at least cosmetically, I suppose, a similar situation unfolding in Brazil. Is there a sense that this is now enough, that the sort of sting has been taken out of that? I mean, perhaps in the way it's being reported, is there a sense of, phew, well, that's over, this has been resolved with a great speech?
Well, at least for me, yes.
I was
very relieved because when I saw the protests rising and people trying to invade the Itamaraty in Brasilia, I was getting worried. I was even worried about coup d'etat, you know, that I know that maybe it's just me being a little bit nervous and paranoid, but you know, never happened, you know, especially in a country where we had the experience of a dictatorship. I mean, not that far ago. I mean, 64. I mean, it's still fairly recent, in my opinion. So, yeah, I'm very relieved. And she, of course, said other things, that she would allocate 50 billion reais for new investments in urban mobility projects and to improve public transport. So there's like a series of measures. And there's a funny thing, actually, on Folha de São Paulo, where the São Paulo governor, Geraldo Alckmin, said that he's cancelled the rides on toll roads as well. So nobody's going to ride anything at the moment.
Our resident Brazilian wearing an excellent pair of shorts today, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Thank you, Fernando. That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to our producer, Danny Giacopelli, our researchers, Fernando, and Anton Fredrickson, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli.
And I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, accompanied by Marcus Hippy. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.